Namaskaram. My name is Nayad. I'm a tour leader with Explore. Come, follow me for a breakfast you will never forget. Namaste. Because you are going to make an incredible masala dosa under the watchful eye of my mom.
Kya baat hai, mom?
Each home adds their special touches. But not everyone gets to join in a traditional family meal. You will if you explore. For global adventures, search exploreworldwide.com. And don't just travel, explore.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi everybody, welcome to Dan Snow's History. The Labour Party are having their conference here in the UK this week. The Labour Party is in opposition here in the UK. If polls are to believe, they're likely to form the next government. And that would make Sir Keir Starmer, their leader, a Labour Party election winner. But who is the greatest Labour election winner of all time? Was it Clem Attlee, who won his crushing 1945 victory? Tony Blair with his three victories? No, it's none of those folks. It's Harold Wilson. He won four general elections, albeit some of them by a very narrow margin indeed. He was the only British Prime Minister since the Second World War to be Prime Minister on non-consecutive occasions. He was allegedly the Queen's favourite Prime Minister, curiously. Who was this man and what can the modern Labour Party learn from his career? Well, I've got Nick Thomas Simmons on the podcast. He is an academic. He's frankly an overachiever. He's an academic. He's a politician. He's a barrister. He is Shadow Secretary of State for International Trade. He's an MP here in the UK. And he writes political biographies in his spare time. Look at this guy. He's just written a biography of the unpetulant, the wily, the strategic Harold Wilson, the Prime Minister who confirmed Britain's membership of the European Economic Community in 1975. And he brought about enormous changes in the UK. He decriminalised homosexuality, he legalised abortion and abolished capital punishment, among other things. It sort of reflected the great societal shift of the 1960s and beyond. At a time when the pound sterling is under threat. And we have the prospect of strike action, of an energy crisis. Perhaps we need to think a little bit more about what's going on in the 1970s and what we can learn from and avoid. So here to talk about Harold Wilson is Nick Thomas Simmons. Enjoy. Nick, thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Absolute pleasure to join you, Dan.
Well, first of all, because the Queen has just died, let's get one thing out of the way. Was Harold Wilson the Queen's favourite Prime Minister?
I think there is certainly a case to be made. Now, Her Late Majesty was always extremely discreet about her personal views, so we'll never know for certain, and that's the way it should be. But there are certainly some pointers. It was only, of course, Winston Churchill and Harold Wilson, upon whom Her Late Majesty bestowed the honour of attending the farewell dinner. But it's also the case that Harold Wilson often had a second weekly audience with Her Late Majesty, and she is said to have found the way that he always behaved towards her as Prime Minister, consulting her before major decisions, to have been something very positive. So there are some pointers that he could well have been the favourite.
Harold Wilson to us can look old, black and white, stilted. But talk me through what kind of politician Harold Wilson was as a young politician. How dynamic, how exciting was he, and what was his background?
So his background is fascinating in terms of shaping the politician that he became. He had a very congregationalist background. He was very religious. You will hear, for example, in his 1962 conference speech, talking about the Labour Party as a moral crusade, or it was nothing. He was also a Boy Scout. So his family had not just this religion, but this sense of wanting to put it into practical effect through public service. And the other thing I think really does influence him, his father was, in fact, an industrial chemist, worked in the dyestuffs industry, worked in the munitions industry in World War I, but underwent bouts of unemployment. Later, Harold's father, Herbert Wilson, said, blame me for his politics. And those periods of unemployment when Harold asked his father for money and there was no money to give profoundly impacted upon him as a politician. He saw unemployment as this moral, social, political evil, high unemployment to be avoided at all costs. So they are, if you like, the tram lines that run through his political career. And whilst in the 1940s, when he was the president of the Board of Trade in Clement Attlee's Labour government, he was a very formal, very staid figure with a tiny moustache. You can still see him on the British Pathé films announcing the end of the wartime controls, the so-called bonfire controls. But he was also adaptable. And by the 1960s, you get this figure with the popular touch who probably, in my view, really captured the zeitgeist of that modernity of the 1960s.
He's an interesting background. You touched on it there. It's fascinating. And he's a grammar school boy. He went and read history at Oxford University. There's a touch of the Tony Blair in the way that he comes from quite a conservative Big C background, doesn't he?
He comes from a socially conservative background, but in terms of his position as the post-war prime minister, he's the first of the post-war prime ministers who wasn't privately educated because he was, of course, a grammar school boy. His father moving around for work, he actually ended up, Harold, as the only sixth former at Wirral Grammar. His father had moved to that area for work. But he was also modern because he was somebody who really did link into that 1960s era. You think of the Beatles, for example, Dan, you know, these working class boys from Liverpool who sang in a different way and had this wonderful popularity, were not hidebound by formality. And Harold was very similar, very accessible. He used to stay at the Adelphi Hotel in Liverpool and people would sing to him, Wilson, yeah, 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 after the Beatles song, She Loves You. But he was also, it has to be said, assisted by the Conservatives. And the way that Alec Douglas Hume succeeded Harold Macmillan, because remember, at that point, there wasn't even an election for the leader of the Conservative Party. It was done on the basis of soundings. And what happens is that Harold Macmillan, from his hospital bed, wants Hume to succeed him. But there's a problem because Hume is hereditary peer. He's at that point in the House of Lords. So the only way he can become prime minister is to disclaim the peerage and then to win election to the House of Commons, which he does do at Perth and Kinross in November of 1963. But there's a period of about 3 weeks, believe it or not, where the prime minister is neither a member of the Commons nor a member of the Lords. I mean, imagine that today. And it led Harold to say that the prime ministership here is being decided by an aristocratic cabal.
And he wasn't entirely wrong about that. Speaking of aristocratic cabals, Wilson, given unlike MacDonald or even Lloyd George, he didn't have a working class upbringing. And yet he, perhaps more than anybody, has been tarnished unfairly with rumours of relations with Moscow, being foreign agent. Can you talk to me about all that?
Yeah, so I think Harold Wilson belongs to what I would call the squeezed middle. I think you've got Ramsay MacDonald, who first Labour Prime Minister, very clearly from that working class background in Lossiemouth in Scotland, that background of poverty. You've then got Clem Attlee, who of course went to Haileybury Public School, very much from a more upper class type background. So Harold Wilson, I think, of these first three Labour Prime Ministers, is what I would describe as being in what Ed Miliband called the squeezed middle. Now, he was someone who got to where he got to really on his own merits, you know, that great degree, actually changed degree to politics, philosophy and economics at Oxford and got all his alpha marks, was a wartime civil servant. And then you get these rumours about the Russian agent stuff, which in my view is nonsense. But where it comes from are essentially two things. Firstly, when he was Secretary of Overseas Trade and then President of the Board of Trade from 1947 to 51, and he was negotiating with Russia, he was accused in a negotiation with the Soviet Union of somehow revealing the designs for jet engines. They call it the jet engines episode. But in reality, the situation was that it was what we needed from the Soviet Union with things like grain and food, and what they needed from us was technology. So it was a perfectly rational thing for him to offer to sell jet engines. That was the thing the Soviet Union wanted from us. And secondly, he actually had a job with a timber exporting company called Montagu Meyer, which in the 1950s was a great political advantage to him for two reasons. One, he could travel on the international stage and often used to report back to some of those old newspapers like Reynolds News, which of course doesn't exist anymore. But also, and this should not be underestimated, it gave him an office on the Strand in an era when, of course, MPs struggled for office space in the House of Commons. But the security services at that time, such as the atmosphere of the Cold War, were always interested in people who travelled beyond the Iron Curtain. But there's absolutely nothing to suggest that Tarrell was a Russian spy at all.
Are those establishment headwinds, was that deliberate? Or was it just a product of hysteria, paranoia during the Cold War by the security service, many of whom, I should point out, appeared to be working for the Soviets themselves? Or was there any truth to it? Or was it just a political attack?
This was an age of suspicion. And I actually come to the conclusion in the book that while he was paranoid about the security services, there was good reason to be paranoid. And we think about this now. If you think back to Spycatcher and Peter Wright, Peter Wright openly on television said that he wanted to bring Harold Wilson down. I'm not suggesting this was a wide plot involving the head of the security services, but there was certainly an element that wanted to do that. And looking at the 1970s as well, there was political motivation against Harold too. So he had every reason to be worried at times and to be suspicious.
Listen to Dan Snow's History. We're talking about the most successful Labour election winner of all time. More coming up.
Death by tiger bites.
Ow.
Death by
Ow.
Prodding. Death from overeating and overdrinking. Death from sexual excess. This is the subject of an obscure 13th century Chinese manual that marks the beginnings of the art of forensic science. I'm Dallas Campbell, and on my podcast, Patented History of Invention, we have a new mini-series about the inventors and innovators behind forensics. I'll take you back to the days of the Raj, 1930s gangland America, and we'll have an access all areas pass inside Britain's most inaccessible museum. Strange deaths, true crimes, weird books, and more. Search for Patented History of Inventions wherever you listen to your podcasts.
I'm Professor Susanna Lipscomb, and on Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, I'm looking for answers to the big questions about every aspect of life in the early modern period. Like, how did the memory of Anne Boleyn continue to influence the court of her daughter, Elizabeth I? How were fairies brought to life on the Elizabethan stage? And how did the arrival of male-only doctors threaten the lives of women? In other words, not just the Tudors, but most definitely also the Tudors. Twice a week, every week. Subscribe now and follow me on Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, wherever you get your podcasts.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Let's talk about domestic achievements now. So much of the Britain that we know, the modern world as we assume it to be, with our more open, tolerant society than it once was, that's a product of Harold Wilson's administrations.
Yes, and these are remarkable changes. As I've already said, Harold was a social conservative, but he saw these reforms as necessary. Many of them took place under Roy Jenkins as Home Secretary. They had backbench origins. I mean, my predecessor but one, Leo Absey, sponsored the Sexual Offences Act, which decriminalised homosexuality. And that's a remarkable thing because prior to that, people couldn't love who they wanted to because they feared the knock on the door from the police. They feared being blackmailed, which was often something that happened to public figures in those days. David Steele's Abortion Act, which of course took away the spectre of backstreet abortions. So Harold had to make sure that his government gave parliamentary time to these things. But it's even wider than that. The Race Relations Act that actually for the first time outlawed discrimination on grounds of race on our statute books. Theatre censorship was abolished, capital punishment abolished, corporal punishment abolished, divorce law reform, which meant that people didn't have to stay in loveless marriages. But also, I think people really underestimate his second government as well, because 1970, Barbara Castle's Equal Pay Act, this was really groundbreaking stuff about men and women treated equally in the first place, came into effect in 1975, and by which time Harold was back in power and essentially laid the foundations of modern-day employment law, you know, the Health and Safety at Work Act, so people actually can be safe at work. That's Harold's second government. There's also ACAS, the conciliation body that today is the port of call to deal with employment disputes, created by Harold's second government. And things like the Employment Protection Act, maternity leave for the first time. These are groundbreaking changes. And that's before we come to the Open University in the late 1960s, which I think is a crowning achievement in our politics about lifelong learning for people.
You've listed some seismic changes that have affected all of our lives. Why do we not think of him as a sort of transformational leader like we think of when we look at the Attlee administration?
I think it's because of how the 70s Labour government ended. History might be very different if James Callaghan had called an election in October 1978. But as it is, we get what became known as the Winter of Discontent. And of course, Margaret Thatcher in the 1980s defined her government against the 1960s and the 1970s. So there came an acceptance in political circles that because of the particular confrontational route that Margaret Thatcher took to industrial relations in the 1980s, that somehow that meant that what had happened in the 60s and 70s and the post-war consensus, as it was known, became completely trashed in historical terms. And therefore, Harold ends up being largely lumped into that and largely forgotten, which I think is a mistake.
He won, albeit quite narrowly in some cases, he won four elections. That is remarkable for a Labour leader. What does his success, what do you think it tells today's crop of progressive politicians?
I think there are some profound lessons in Harold's period. Since 1951 so far, only two Labour leaders have won general elections. Harold Wilson won four, Tony Blair won three. But what Harold was principally about really is a lesson, I think, to us, which is firstly, he looked forward. If you look at 1964, you know, that famous white heat of technology speech in October 1963 about how he was going to harness science with socialism. He looked to the future, very similar in 1974 with his idea of the social contract, of political and social reform in exchange for restraint on pay. Again, looking forward. But the second thing is, he offered practical solutions as to how he could make people's everyday lives better. And I think those two things, looking forward, but practical solutions that people can relate to, are both really important for us as we survey the 2020s.
It's interesting, isn't it, that Attlee, Blair and Wilson, three successful Labour leaders, none of them are anywhere near the Tory pastiche, the cliche that they're actually secret Marxists who are trying to overturn the British constitution, get rid of the monarchy, upend sort of centuries of British tradition. You know, in fact, Attlee carried Churchill's coffin. Wilson was arguably the Queen's favourite prime minister. Tony Blair is now lamented by his own party as having not gone far enough. Is there a lesson there? And does it speak to just the difficulty of being in that position of Labour leader? How do you position yourself within kind of the British conversation?
Well, each of those leaders was making the case for change in Britain. If you look at Clem Attlee's transformational 1945 manifesto and everything that was created after that, you know, the foundations of post-war foreign policy, the welfare state, the NHS. 1964, Harold Wilson was making the case of the 13 wasted Tory years and how he was going to reboot the economy in terms of the white heat of technology, as I've mentioned. 1997, public services on their knees. Tony Blair arguing Britain deserves better. And of course, what happens when you make those criticisms is the Conservative governments of the time always say, well, you see, the opposition is talking down the country. When, of course, we're not talking down the country. We are talking down the Conservative government that is not allowing the country to reach its potential. And it's getting that right. It's pushing back hard. When Conservatives say that you're talking the country down, we're not at all. We're talking the government of the country down, the Conservative government that's letting the country down.
I was struck by Keir Starmer and, you know, you and senior members of your party during the recent death of the sovereign, because, of course, the noisy activists on Twitter are like, here's the opportunity to get rid of a whole lot, a bunch of them. And Labour was very robust in its communications around the attachment to a constitutional monarchy going forward in the UK. And I wonder if this is the kind of issue, the kind of booby trap that Wilson would have been used to dealing with.
He certainly was, and Harold was very attached to Her Late Majesty the Queen, thoroughly enjoyed the weekly audiences and thoroughly enjoyed drawing on her wisdom. And that's been the case for every single one of the post-war Labour prime ministers who had audiences with the late Majesty Queen Elizabeth II. So I would challenge that interpretation, because every single Labour prime minister has had this respect for the constitutional monarchy. And indeed, every single one of them, without exception, has benefited from it. And that will be the case for the next Labour prime minister as well.
And yet, it must be so frustrating then. You get hammered constantly by, I mean, this is what opposing parties do to each other, but you get hammered constantly as unpatriotic, insufficiently interested in the great and glorious traditions of Britain. I mean, that's what I find so interesting about centre-left progressive parties in the modern world, is they can find that sometimes the cliff edge is very difficult to stand on.
This is how progressive parties are attacked from the right. And these days, there are a number of different additional arenas to do it in, including social media. But yet, when we talk about some great British institutions that we are all attached to, they are Labour creations. The National Health Service, great British institution, Labour creation. NATO, which is the foundation stone of post-war British foreign policy, that's Clem Attlee and Ernie Bevin who created NATO. So sometimes I think on the progressive side of politics, we mustn't be afraid of seizing these great patriotic traditions as our own, because some of them frankly are.
Whenever I get a politician on the podcast, I'm always fascinated to ask what history means to them. You are a historian. You're also a member of parliament and a member of the shadow Labour administration. Like, what Is this practical? Is this just exercising your own intellect and writing for a general audience? Or do you want practitioners and politicians to take lessons and have their thoughts and policies shaped by what you've written in this book?
What I really want to give is a sense of context. And I know, as you know, Dan, history doesn't perfectly repeat itself, but it is true that politicians of the past have faced very, very similar dilemmas. And so often, I think, we hear this talk, this rhetoric, that something's unprecedented or something's completely new. And I often get frustrated looking at it because I can see examples from history where this similar dilemma has presented itself. And whilst, of course, we must always recognise that times have changed and look to the future, the lessons in history are there, but often it's almost as if we choose not to look for them.
So go on. Keir Starmer says, I loved your book. That was brilliant. I'm sure you sit down with him all the time, but particularly about the subject of Spoken Wilson. What are you telling him? What are the lessons from Harold Wilson to Keir Starmer and other progressive politicians in our modern world?
Well, I was lucky enough to have Keir at the launch of the book, which happened before Her Late Majesty passed away. So I know that Keir has been reading the book. And my message, whether it's to Keir or indeed other progressive leaders around the world, is it's about, first of all, being yourself. Wilson had his very distinct personality and the things that people now don't remember him for, but did at the time, you know, the pipe, the Gannex raincoat, the HP sauce, all these things. So it's about, first of all, being you and being authentic to yourself in leadership roles. But secondly, it is about how can I improve the country and do it in a practical sense? And that is exactly what, in my view, Harold Wilson did.
Well, thank you very much. That was great. Nick, what is the name of the book? Tell us all.
So it is Harold Wilson, The Winner. It is published by Weidenfeld and Nicholson. It came out on the 1st of September, and it is now available, complete with Keir Starmer quote on the front cover.
Crikey. Nick Thomas Simmons, thank you very much for coming on the pod.
Pleasure.
I feel the hand of history upon our shoulders.
All this tradition of ours, our school history, our songs, this part of the history of our country, all were gone.
Namaskaram, my name is Nayad. I'm a tour leader with Explore. Come, follow me for a breakfast you will never forget.
Namaste.
Because you are going to make an incredible masala dosa under the watchful eye of my mom.
Kya baat hai, mom?
Each home adds their special touches. But not everyone gets to join in a traditional family meal. You will if you explore. For global adventures, search exploreworldwide.com. And don't just travel, explore.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com, code program.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dan Snow's History Hit. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us and you'll be doing us a big favour. Don't forget, you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of TV documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code Dan Snow at checkout.